This is Sound Ideas. I'm Willis Kern. Bloomington wants to end its 30-year West Side tax zone deal with Normal. So what now?
The trust between those two municipalities is going to be critical, and this has certainly eroded that trust.
Mayor of Normal Chris Koos reacts to Bloomington's decision. Charlie Schlenker has an in-depth report with representatives from both sides. The community's chief economic developer is in the studio to weigh in. You'll hear from EDC CEO Kyle Hamm. And ISU President Larry Dietz talks about higher ed funding, the search for a new vice president, and new university trustees. That and a GLT News update on the way. It's February 22nd, 2017. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT. With additional support from the Jack Baytall Real Estate Group, more information at jackknowshomes.com. This is GLT.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Willis Kern. Bloomington and Normal are headed for a showdown over a 30-year-old agreement that shares tax revenue and service and infrastructure expenses on the west side of the community. WGLT's Charlie Schlenker has this report.
Mayor Terry Renner of Bloomington says the city council will consider a resolution next week to terminate the Metro Zone agreement. That's something Mayor Chris Koos of Normal says can't be done unilaterally.
The agreement says can be terminated by mutual agreement of the party.
The council signaled during an executive session Monday night to move forward with dissolving the sales tax, property tax, infrastructure, and service cost-sharing zone. The pact came about in 1986 to give both municipalities an incentive to improve the west side of town as part of the arrival of the Mitsubishi plant. Both cities made infrastructure investments. The reason given for the executive session of the Bloomington Council Monday evening to talk about the issue was pending or probable litigation. There is no current court case, and Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner said he doubts there will be a lawsuit.
I don't think it helps anybody to go into litigation. And second, I think they're probably getting the same kind of legal advice that we're getting. There is no agreement that is perpetual. You do have a right under Illinois law. Either side can terminate.
You know, going forward, the trust between those two municipalities is going to be critical. And this has certainly eroded that trust.
That's Mayor Chris Koos. Renner said for the first decade of the pact, Bloomington benefited disproportionately from the agreement. For some years after that, revenues roughly balanced. But in the last decade, Renner says Bloomington has been sending more to Normal, including about a $1.2 million sum last year because of the healthy sales tax receipts from the Westside Walmart and other retailers. Koos points out Normal agreed to abate taxes on that store for the good of the community, even though the town knew sales tax receipts from the Eastside Walmart would drop by about 15% as a result. Renner says over the history of the Metro Zone, Bloomington has sent to Normal about $12 million, and Normal has sent to Bloomington about $5 million.
So there's clearly an inequity in this agreement. And that, I think, is what the council is responding to.
Mayor Koos resisted that comparison. Koos points out both parties split the cost of infrastructure improvements 50-50. The city of Bloomington approached Normal about support for the Walmart under the Metro Zone agreement, Koos says, and Normal City Manager Mark Peterson says the agreement also divides the cost of services such as police and fire protection. Renner maintains the agreement is no longer in the best interests of Bloomington taxpayers.
Both parties have been made whole 20 years ago in terms of their investment. So it's not like anybody's really out any of their initial investment.
Normal council member Kevin McCarthy compared the arrangement to a business partnership.
From our perspective, there is no inequity. We both invested equally. We both received revenue equally.
Koos says the town has tried to have a conversation about the agreement and has been stiffed.
We're not looking at the Metro Zone agreement in black and white. We're not saying it either stays or it goes away. That's not our position. Our position is we want to talk with the city of Bloomington and see if there's anything salvageable in the agreement, if it's amendable, if it needs to change, if it needs to go away, how does it go away, how do we come out of it okay, how do they come out of it okay. That's the discussion we're trying to have.
Renner says the issue has been a topic for several years, and talks have been going on for 4 or 5 months. Coos disputed that, saying there is a history of sporadic contact on the topic between city managers Mark Peterson and David Hales, and the actual discussions have been much more recent.
We've been talking about it since December.
Town Council member Kevin McCarthy was part of a small team from Normal that met twice with like representatives from Bloomington.
We had a business partnership, a joint investment in an area. One partner says they're not happy with how the investment's going, and we try to have a conversation about how do we update the partnership, and you don't even get to have that discussion. You have a discussion about whether or not we want to have that discussion, and then one decides, nope, we're not going to have this discussion, we're just going to dissolve it, and P.S., we're going to take all the assets.
Alderman Amelia Burgess was on the Bloomington team that held discussions with the town. Burgess declined comment. Renner characterized the talks as involving several proposed compromises on both sides and said the cities were not able to reach common ground.
So I want to make it clear that the Bloomington City Council is not acting rashly or quickly. In fact, there were many that were concerned that we had been dragging our feet on this.
Coos says at the last meeting of the working groups, there was a common agreement that they would continue to move forward and keep talking. After that, Normal representatives contend Bloomington went silent. Coos says the agreement is one of the most enduring and successful in the history of the two municipalities. Mayor Renner has a different take.
You look out there at this point, anybody, you can see that the type of development or economic growth that we thought might happen 30 years ago has not really happened, or it's been uneven at best. So at this point, the thing that we also have to realize is that in the entire 30 years, Bloomington has sent to Normal over $12 million, and Normal has sent to Bloomington about $5 million. So there's clearly an inequity in this agreement. And that, I think, is what the council is responding to.
Normal City Manager Mark Peterson notes the entire community has had little growth in commercial and manufacturing development over the last decade, as have many communities around the nation. Renner said the town has spent most of the last decade focused on uptown. Mayor Coos has a rejoinder.
And most of his focus has been on downtown Bloomington.
City Manager Mark Peterson of Normal disagreed with Renner's premise.
I would first of all dispute that. Look what we have done in support of Mitsubishi. The town has been very active and aggressive in supporting Mitsubishi. Unfortunately, the plant was not successful at the end of the day. And then we participated in a very robust community effort to try to attract a replacement that was successful.
Renner also discounts the potential impact on the Metro Zone agreement of the Rivian Automotive project. He says he doubts it will prove to be significant. At the time of the Rivian announcement, the city of Bloomington declined to participate in incentives, even though the plant is within the metro zone. Coos acknowledged the impact of Rivian is unproven, but holds out hope it could be significant.
It should matter to both parties because it's likely to be a significant tax generator when the plant comes online and is retooled.
Renner says he hopes a new and better agreement can be crafted that will help develop the community and be consistent with the BN Advantage initiative.
Essentially trying to make sure that we have the best trained workforce in downstate, that we're even attracting IT jobs. There's any number of things that BN Advantage might work for.
Renner acknowledges the Metro Zone issue has made the relationship between the two cities difficult. He says it is just one of those things that they have to agree to disagree on and move forward because obviously neither entity is going anywhere.
I think that there's some strain, and I think some of that is because of some misunderstandings over this and some other issues. I mean, we're going to work together. We have dozens and dozens and dozens of intergovernmental agreements on police and fire. We work together all the time. And so, obviously, we will get past this and we will move forward and we will have some sort of BN Advantage agreement to promote the economic development of the entire community moving forward.
The City of Bloomington news release on the topic cites a resolution calling for a new process of joint collaboration. Renner explains what is meant by that.
I would like at some point for us in the very near future maybe to get a fifth Monday where we get the 9 members of Bloomington City Council and myself as mayor and the 7 members of the Normal Town Council, including Mayor Coos, together in the same room in an open public forum and begin to talk about what the next phases might be.
Even after expressing distress at the development, Mayor Coos is trying to make nice.
We've heard from the city of Bloomington that they're interested in new agreements, whether it's Metro Zone, whether it's other things in the community, but collaborative agreements, and we would like to pursue that as well.
The Metro Zone is a sector-based approach to economic development. Mayor Renner says the Twin Cities need to come together in a fresh approach for something that is a community-based, not sector-based, initiative. I'm Charlie Schlenker.
The Bloomington Council meets Monday night to consider dissolving the Metro Zone. The normal council will then have to decide whether to sue or just how to proceed. You're tuned to Sound Ideas. I'm Willis Kern, and in the studio to talk about this dispute and the possible effect on economic development is the community's chief economic strategist, Kyle Hamm, CEO of the Bloomington Normal Economic Development Council. Thanks for joining us today on Sound Ideas.
Thanks for having me.
What's your reaction to Charlie Schlenker's report?
Well, you know, hearing both sides, it's a little frustrating that we've come to this where, you know, the communities are not able to really sit down and talk about what's next and maybe come to terms with what they have been doing. But, you know, I remain confident that the communities will continue to work together to try and find the best solutions for what we can do to grow our economy.
Would you characterize the failure to negotiate a resolution to this as a self-inflicted wound to the community in a way?
It's possible. You know, I think that there's a lot to be seen with, you know, how this shakes out over the next few weeks. But, you know, I know having worked with both Bloomington and Normal, you know, tremendous people that I think at some point we'll sit down and have a dialogue. You know, it's kind of like family members, you know, brothers and sisters fight. Sometimes it's not pretty, but you come back together because, you know, we're all in this together. You know, McLean County needs to be seen as one community and one voice. And the more that we can work together and collaborate, it only helps all of us.
What's your interpretation of this agreement? Can one party terminate the Metro Zone agreement as you understand it?
You know, I've heard both Normal and Bloomington, both sides, I think both have valid points to the Metro Zone. I won't delve into sort of the legal aspects of it. I think that's for both communities and their attorneys to sort of sift through. You know, we at the EDC, I think also with the Being Advantage in the chamber, the business community has said our number one priority is that the communities continue to talk, have dialogue, make it sure that's civil, and that they can come together and find best solutions that is a win-win for both. That is the overriding message that we want to carry forward is continue to collaborate and work together because our success as a community as a whole really is based on the communities going in the same direction, thinking the same direction, and prioritizing growth, economic development. That's really where we all win.
As the CEO of the chief economic development arm in the Twin Cities, what do you think this dispute says about relations between the two communities? You've already characterized it as a kind of like brother and sister fighting.
You know, I've only been here 2 years, and I've found that this community does work really well together. There's certainly a history of that. This Metro Zone is a perfect example of something that's been a long-time partnership between the communities. And I think like all partnerships, you have to evaluate where they sit currently from time to time. But at the end of the day, it boils down to dialogue. It boils down to working together, give and take on both sides. And that's what we would hope that we can continue to encourage is that folks will come together to come to best practice and best solution.
Well, let me ask you a little bit differently then. What does this telegraph to corporations or businesses or organizations or entrepreneurs who are thinking about locating in this community?
Well, I don't think it's unusual that that communities that live next to each other, you know, might have certain types of disputes. I think really what going forward is how this is handled in future situations. I think the writing's pretty well on the wall that Bloomington's decided to move on. How both Bloomington and Normal react to that over the coming weeks and months will really determine what the outside world is looking in at us and saying about our ability to come back together. So, you know, this certainly is a challenge for our community. It does, you know, create the headlines that there's discontention here. But hopefully over the next few weeks, people will be back at the table and we can mend some of those things that have been hurt.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Willis Kernan. We're visiting with Bloomington Normal Economic Development Council CEO Kyle Hamm. We're talking about the Metrozone agreement between the two municipalities that Bloomington wants to dissolve. What should shared economic development efforts from both the city and the town look like? Is that BN Advantage, and is this dispute going to have a negative effect on the efforts of BN Advantage, do you think?
BN Advantage is our five-year economic development strategy. It's focused on things like workforce, entrepreneurship, quality of life, marketing and communicating the community both internally to our citizens that live here, but also externally. So what is our brand? What is our message to the people outside looking in, and particularly businesses that are looking to move to the Midwest or move to Illinois? What is our message outward? And so BN Advantage, one of the number one goals is collaboration and communication amongst our players, our businesses, our governments, our nonprofits. And that's really where we're going to be focused on. And so, you know, this dispute certainly causes a challenge for BN Advantage, but from the business perspective, we're pushing forward. We believe that this community has so many vibrant assets. You know, when you compare us to other communities around the state of Illinois, whether it's education, whether it's quality of life, crime rates, unemployment, you know, quality of workforce, education of our workforce, we stand out. And so we have to take advantage of that. And I would encourage all of our leaders that that's what we should be focused on, where we find common ground, where we can work together, because we only benefit by doing so.
The Metrozone really seemed to be a forgotten document until about a year ago, when this idea of a shared tax, sales tax discussion sprung up. Last spring and during the summer of last year, there really wasn't a proposal at all, but a discussion about creating a proposal to share sales taxes between the city and the town. Here's Jared Hall. He's the EDC board vice chairperson, speaking to the council in June.
In the EDC's view, regional cooperation amongst public and private entities, as well as local government entities, is important for economic growth, and therefore the EDC, by unanimous vote, suggests that the council consider and have this conversation, just move forward and discuss this initiative with the town of Bloomington.
So, is the Metrozone the victim of this discussion, or how would you characterize and put the Metrozone in the context of this shared sales tax?
I'm not sure that they're related. I think they might be separate, but. Again, the sales tax sharing, as you heard from Jared, our vantage point was not weighing in on the pros and cons of sales tax sharing, was simply encouraging the communities to have a dialogue. We expect Bloomington and Normal both to have separate priorities when it comes to growth areas, whether it's uptown or downtown Bloomington, and they should. But when we look at growth as a whole, we should all be saying the same things. We should all be talking the same things and looking at our incentives collectively together, not competing against, Bloomington Normal. We're competing against the Midwest. We're competing against the U.S. and global. And our strength is in working together and having a sound mind and sound voice. So, you know, that's what we continue to sort of harp on, I guess, if you will, whether you're a business community or the EDC, is that we work together, that this isn't a competition between these two communities. And I guess maybe that's one of the things we are concerned about, is that there could be a perception, whether it's reality or not, a perception that these communities aren't willing to work together.
Before we leave the shared sales tax concept, I want to ask one more question about it. The EDC is one of the organizations that went on board last summer endorsing this concept. Maybe you can talk a little bit about what do you see as the advantages of it?
You know, I think the advantages are the first probably glaring advantage of a sales tax sharing is it takes away that notion of competition, that we promote our community as one, and that any business that grows, any business that expands, they find the best location, they find the best site in our community. We're not playing tug of war between the communities. Once they've found their best site, the entire community benefits from that business moving here or locating here. And there's none of this back and forth about whether, the company was originally going to be in one town or the other. It simply is, what can we do as a community to grow and prosper and benefit together.
The resolution that's going to be for the Bloomington City Council on Monday night calls for, quote, a new process of joint collaboration between the City of Bloomington and Town of Normal on regional economic development, end quote. Now, if that's not a shared sales tax agreement, what is it?
I think it's a whole host of things. It's about how they invest in economic development. Being Advantage right now is a strategy. It needs the resources to move forward. So we have task forces in place that are putting together marketing and communication strategies for recruiting new businesses and target markets to this community. It's about maximizing our opportunities with workforce. It's about growing entrepreneurship and bringing back the opportunity for people or individuals to start their own companies here and create a culture of entrepreneurship. It's about creating the best quality of life so that when a business does move here, their employees see this as a place that they want to be and stay and live and raise their families. So those are the things that are already in place that both communities can come together and say, you know what, we believe in all of this. Let's invest in economic development together. It could also mean creating certain types of incentives that are equal, that whether it's some of the sales tax or tax abatements, again, just as general subject matter, how could they equally be on same footing to say we're going to match up our incentives? We're not going to have an unfair advantage from one community to the next, and then you begin bidding wars.
Kyle Hamm is the CEO of the Bloomington Normal Economic Development Council. Thanks so much for being here today on Sound Ideas.
Thank you.
Support for GLT comes from the Peoria Riverfront Museum, welcoming visitors aboard Titanic, the artifact exhibition featuring authentic artifacts and extensive recreations, plus a variety of Titanic-themed special activities for children, teens, and adults. Schedule and details at riverfrontmuseum.org. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
And at Sound Ideas, I'm Willis Kern. For the first time in his annual budget address, Governor Bruce Rauner is proposing an increase in some funding for higher education. In his speech a week ago, the governor said he is willing to increase MAP grant funding by 10%. With us, as he is every month, is Illinois State University President Larry Dietz. Thanks for coming by.
Always a pleasure. Thanks, Willis.
While the governor didn't address direct higher ed funding levels during his speech, he is asking for higher ed to be funded at 85% of its FY 2015 appropriation. That's better than the FY 2016 appropriation, which was basically zero, although there were some funds that came through with a stopgap measure. Politically, do you think this is just a starting point in talks, and this could go up or maybe down?
Well, we certainly hope that it goes up. We appreciated the governor's idea that we need funding. We certainly do need funding. We need a budget. And the 85% is certainly a good starting point to have some conversations. The other point about MAP, we need an increase in MAP as well. But all of that MAP is a part of a budget. And so we really need a budget first, and then what is in that budget, including MAP and so forth, we hope that'll become a part of the budget. But we hope this is a part of renewed discussions and more serious discussions about getting a budget.
And I want to talk about MAP in just a moment. But first of all, as part of his budget proposal, there is a chance here for schools to earn another 5% by hitting certain performance goals. Now, we've talked about this concept before. For universities, these performance bonuses really haven't materialized yet. Are they just a victim of this political process, or is there something wrong with how these performance bonuses are being developed and possibly at least the proposal for them to be distributed?
Well, on the surface, I don't think anyone is opposed to the idea or the concept of performance bonuses. I do think, though, that the institutions are doing as well as they can with what they have, and right now what they have is no budget. And so the idea that anything is really going to be turned around in terms of the way that we do business with only dedicating 5% of the budget, which we don't have. But if we did have a budget, only 5% of that budget to performance funding really has been proven in most other cases in other states that really doesn't work. I mean, our performance at Illinois State University has been very high. If you look at Retention rates and graduation rates, we're in the top 10% in the nation. If you look at our enrollment is up. If you look at our fundraising objectives, we've been meeting those objectives and exceeding those for quite some time. Faculty performance is up. The faculty-student ratio has remained about the same despite, you know, lack of budget. So we feel like that we've been performing as an institution for a long period of time.
Let's get back to the monetary award program. Now, that's what MAP stands for. He talked about this, but only very briefly in his speech. He mentioned the 10% increase that he was going to be proposing. What was your impression overall of what the governor said about MAP and higher education?
MAP funding is clearly very, very important for the individuals who have financial need, and we need more of that money, not less. And so his idea that we would have an increase in the fund is certainly welcome for all of us. But thus far, this year, we've received no appropriation for MAP at all. And so institutions are funding what is the really a state program, and we did that last year, and we've been doing that this year. Luckily, at the end of last year, there was an approval for the funding that we should have received at the beginning of the year. We're still receiving for last year, so we hope that that'll be funded. But clearly an increase in MAP funding would be welcome. We have about 4,000 students currently at Illinois State who take advantage of that, and it's a very important program.
Eric Zarnico is in charge of the Illinois MAP program. He said a 10% hike could accommodate an additional 12,000 students or an increase in the size of the grants. If Illinois State is involved in a 10% increase in MAP funding, how many more above the 4,000 would that accommodate, or would you spread that money out among those people?
Well, it would depend on the agreement. Oftentimes, there are caps on how much money the MAP grant will cover. We could do either or both, but clearly we have more students that need MAP money than actually get it. We also find that it's been a traditional that students who apply late for the MAP don't get any money because the money's already been exhausted. And some of our neediest students tend to be sometimes the least in the know about how to manage and navigate university systems and state systems for that matter. So some of the neediest students sometimes apply late because they don't have the information, and when they do that, they oftentimes find that the MAP funds have been exhausted. So an increase would help in many, many ways.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Willis Kern with Illinois State University President Larry Dietz. An Illinois House committee has cleared a proposal that would require public universities to admit first-time freshman applicants who finish with a GPA in the top 10% of their high school's graduating class. Now, the House Higher Ed Committee passed this bill despite opposition from the Illinois Board of Higher Education and the University of Illinois. What do you think of this plan?
Well, I think on the surface, one would look at this and think that it's a good idea. The difficulty comes in the implementation and kind of in the second level. It depends on the high school that students will be graduating from. There's a variety and a great disparity in the performance levels of high schools across the state of Illinois. So the idea that you've done well at a GPA at one high school may not and probably won't mean the same thing for a student that may have graduated from another high school. And so there's a disparity in that performance. One of the things I think we don't want to do is to lead students on and find out later on that while they may have had a good grade point average, that they didn't do well on the ACT, and that they're in over their head once they would automatically get admitted. Second part of this issue is that students may be admitted under this proposal to a given institution, but they didn't talk about particular programs within that institution. So there's usually a two-tier level of admissions. One is to the university generally. Then oftentimes there are different admissions criteria and higher admissions criteria for specific programs. So we really wouldn't want to mislead the student thinking that if they wanted to get into engineering, for example, at a particular institution, that they could get in the university and then automatically get into engineering. So as in most cases, the devil's in the detail, and I think there's a lot of detail to be worked out here.
Well, apparently diversity is at the key of this proposal. The Urbana U of I campus is cited by the sponsor of the bill for its 5.4% African-American enrollment. Does Illinois State's diversity numbers present a strong counterargument for this?
Well, we've been doing very well for the last 3 years, and actually some been making some strides before that. For the last 3 years, we've had the largest and most diverse freshman class that we've had in 25 years. And so nearly 22% of our overall population are from underrepresented groups. And we had about a 9% increase in African-American students this last year in our freshman class, and about an 8% in Latino students. And so we feel like that we're doing well with the diversity issues from the student recruitment perspective.
I guess the bigger argument against this from Illinois State's perspective is not so much from a diversity standpoint, but more from a one-size-fits-all.
Exactly. Yeah. Yes.
By the narrowest of margins, the U.S. Senate confirmed a new education secretary, Betsy DeVos, despite bipartisan cries that she's unqualified for the post and earned the nomination mainly through hefty political contributions. What's your impression of DeVos, and are you concerned that her appointment sends a chilling message to parents of children who may ultimately one day be considering to attend Illinois State?
Well, I personally don't know the new secretary, and have never had a conversation, and probably won't. But based upon what I've read and what I've seen, I think that all of us that work in public higher education have a concern about her not having experience in the public sector, and most students get educated in the public sector. And so we know that she's a strong charter schools advocate, and there are other philosophical issues oftentimes that goes with that related to vouchers and so forth, and privatizing education. And she does have a strong background in the private sector in education, but really has no background in the public side. And so I think most of us that that are doing business on the public side we're in a wait and see. I'm an internal optimist on these things. I think that people can be educated about issues that maybe she's not aware of at this point, and we stand ready to help with that process.
Are you confident that if the system proves that she's incompetent for the job, that ultimately the Peter principle will apply here, and somebody adequate for it will eventually become the education secretary if she's not that person?
Well, you know, I think that you know, people are well-intended with these appointments, and I think with every new person, you don't know until you see the work that's happening. And I believe strongly that systems can correct themselves, and so if that needs to happen, hopefully she'll do some self-correction herself, and if it works, we're happy for her. So, but we would stand ready to work with the issues that she tries to address, and also try to influence her positions on some of these.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Willis Kern with Illinois State University President Larry Dietz. Let's take a look at some of the things that are going on here on campus and talk about some of these. You're in the final stages of selecting a new vice president for finance and planning. Where is that search going, and when do you expect candidates to be on campus for interviews?
Well, first of all, let me say a huge thanks to Greg Ault, who's been our vice president for finance and planning, and I hired him on a permanent basis, but knew at the time that his permanency was going to be limited, and that he had plans to retire, and he's going to be doing that at the latter part of this spring. And so he's done a terrific job of helping us navigate very, very choppy financial waters within the state. So kudos to him. We have launched a search and have been successful in some airport interviews. And from those airport interviews that happened last week, we'll be inviting some folks to the campus. And last that I knew, the last 2 days of February and the 1st of March were the 3 days that we were hoping to bring in those candidates. And hopefully we'll have a decision quickly thereafter. And if we were able to have a little bit of an overlap between Greg and this new person, that would be very helpful to the person and to the institution. But things are moving along very well.
Last week, three new members of the Governing Board of Trustees were sworn into office, and they were assigned to committee work. What do you expect of each of them to bring to the table?
Well, I was very impressed with them. I had called them the day that we learned that they were appointed, and was also thankful that the governor moved swiftly with his appointments. Wonderful people, all alums, all know the institution, all came at different times and had different experiences, but one is an attorney, the other two are business folks. One of the business individuals had also been played football here, so there's an athletic perspective on that.
You're talking about John Rauschenberger.
Yes, right? Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. Sharon Rossmark, a terrific individual. Julie Jones, another terrific individual. I've known Julie from her work with the Black Colleagues Association, and we've had great private conversations, and we had an orientation that happened before the board meeting last Friday when they were sworn in, and all engaging, all passionate about the institution, all want a budget, as if you know, everybody else does as well. But they're very bright, very engaged, very passionate folks for this institution. So I'm really looking forward to working with them and the remaining members of the board.
Generally, what's the learning curve for a new Board of Trustees member, especially when three come on at once? How long does it usually take them to gel as a unit?
You know, it really doesn't take very long, and I think the advantage of the issues, it takes a while to get them up to speed on specific issues, and those will vary by time of the year. In the spring, we tend to work on some things that are perhaps a little bit differently than things that we do in the fall. And the summer meeting is different than the spring and the fall. So there are particular issues that generally are happen during those time frames. But the thing, as I mentioned, that makes it so much easier is that they know about the institution. They have their degrees from here. They've kept up with it. They have continued to be engaged. And so you're really not starting at ground zero. You're starting well above that. And that's been very helpful. I think the other thing they'll find is that this board has a history of being a very collegial board, respecting shared governance. They've supported the presidents of the institutions and have always done the right thing, in my estimation. So I think they'll find that to be the case, and they're going to be a part of the group that are going to continue to do the right thing by the institution.
Next month marks the third anniversary of Larry Dietz's selection as president of Illinois State University, and since that time he has joined us monthly during Sound Ideas. And President Dietz, we appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Always a pleasure.
Say you have a baby.
Do you see the owl?
Yeah, right there.
You raise her with love.
One day I'm going to be able to tell her, you can do this. Push yourself.
The kid's going to turn out exactly as you planned, right?
Yeah.
Hold on here. It would be nice if life was like that, but life isn't like that. Life is hard.
Are we bound by our DNA? Or can a parent change it? That's on the next Radio Lab. Listen Sunday at 11 on GLT News and Ideas.
Support for GLT Sound Ideas comes from the Jack Baytall Real Estate Group at Keller Williams, committed to helping you find the right match. Buying or selling your home can be easy. More information at jacksguarantee.com. This is GLT.
And this is Sound Ideas. I'm Willis Kern. The moral debate between personal freedom and national security is a part of many conversations these days. It's also key to the recent blockbuster movie Captain America: Civil War. The film earned over $1 billion at movie theaters worldwide, but it did more than just boffo box office. It inspired fans to take a closer look at the characters and their struggles, including two Illinois State University psychology professors who used the film as a prism through which to examine the psychology of morality in the Marvel Universe and our own. GLT's Laura Kennedy has more.
The ink of Marvel Comics does more than inspire movies and relate fantastic tales. Comic books, graphic novels, and superhero movies can inspire serious examinations of our moral systems. That's what psychology professors and Marvel fans Eric Wesselman and Scott Jordan have done in the new book Captain America vs. Iron Man: Freedom, Security, Psychology. It's a collection of essays, and the two professors collaborated on a chapter called Wild Heroes: The Hard Work of Being Moral, which delves into the hard choices our superheroes make. Jordan says Marvel works are modern mythological tales told in a different format, stories that can present moral conundrums for the characters and readers. Wesselman notes that comic books and other pop culture provide ample fodder for psychological exploration of morality. The two professors were attending WizardCon in Chicago recently and met editor Travis Langley, who was holding a panel on the psychology of The Walking Dead. Soon thereafter, an invitation was issued.
He was working on this other book at the time, so he emailed us and said, you know, hey, we've got room for a chapter on this other book that's moving quickly. You like comics. I imagine you'd want to be in. Do you want to be? And I think the first email I sent back was yes, and that was it, you know. Mm-hmm. And then the second one, 30 seconds later, was a little bit more composed. So
it seems like a dream come true that you can combine your love of comics with your love of psychology.
It's exciting to be able to say things that we usually say to other scholars in a medium more accessible to the public. And I think that's one thing that Travis does really well about these books is they are psychology topics that use popular culture themes as a way to teach the public about psychology.
So you address morality with regards to Captain America Civil War in your chapter. What are you trying to get us to understand and see in these characters who are facing these interesting moral decisions? First of all, tell me about the moral decisions the characters are facing and your analysis.
Well, the
you do Iron Man and I'll do Cap. You do Iron Man and I'll do Cap.
So Scott is Captain America. Eric, you're Iron Man.
Depends on the day.
Okay.
We can switch the roles.
Yeah,
if
there you go.
Like.
The way that the story is often presented in the, for example, like with the movie posters and stuff, is, you know, freedom versus security. I mean, that's also what was a part of the book title, and that's a real big crux of them. They're facing lots of moral issues, but one of the biggest ones is that what are their roles as heroes? What are their responsibilities as heroes to the people they're protecting? You know, it's not just fighting the villain, you know, and then going home and having a coffee or whatever.
You have a metal arm? That is awesome, dude! You have the right to remain solid!
When the gods fight, mortals suffer, and there's collateral damage. And to what degree do they have to own that, or should they own that? And that's a big thing that they struggle with throughout that entire story arc.
Man, the federal government tries to get them to have to register with the federal government as superheroes. And so Tony Stark as Iron Man sees this as a necessary next step for superheroism. And Captain America refuses, given the kind of character he is. He takes seriously the risks and suffering of the heroes and considers the Registration Act a sort of betrayal of the commitment that people like Captain America have given to the culture.
You're not going to stop me.
You know I can't.
I'm gonna regret this.
That central tension between should they register with the government or not is what drives the story.
And if I may piggyback on that, part of, you know, Captain America's backstory is that, you know, he was a soldier during World War II. And so one of the points he makes in one of his side stories that tie in is that he also doesn't like the fact that part of what he thinks is that superheroes should sort of be a force onto themselves to be able to make their own judgments as a community and not be told what to do, who the bad person is and who the good person is, right? Because that's great if the people in charge of them have society's best interests at heart, but being as he is from the World War II era, he knows what happens when there is a government in charge that doesn't necessarily have society's best interests.
Stark tell you anything else?
That you're wrong? You think you're right? It makes you dangerous.
And to bring it home in a more contemporary context, we're dealing with the issue of freedom versus security right now as a culture. And the advantage of these comic books is that younger and older people who are reading this sorts of material suddenly get engaged in this conversation in a fairly deep way, I'd argue. And with a little coaching from certain people, they might see the parallels to contemporary social issues. I think that's extremely valuable.
Are these Marvel superheroes, are their morals set in stone, or do their morals shift as the story goes on, as they interact with each other and argue and literally fight with one another? I mean, do we see the fact that they can actually see the other's point of view? Maybe their point of view is shifting.
That's the arc, is that they do go through changes. And they regret some sacrifices they made in the name of certain moral choices. Two main characters specifically do end up changing. In the comic, Captain America actually surrenders because the violence being generated in the name of his commitment to his moral code outweighs the good he thinks he's doing. And Tony Stark ends up very much lamenting the choices he made. I don't want to give up too many spoilers.
Right, right. Yeah.
But really bad things happen to certain people close to Tony Stark, and he ends up saying it wasn't worth it.
And Captain America's sort of change of heart line is great when actually their side is winning at that point in time. And, you know, as Scott said, Captain America looks around and sees all of the damage and all of the people suffering, and he stops and he says, you know, we're winning everything but the argument. you know, and so he surrenders, knowing full well that that means that he is now not just a prisoner, but he will likely be executed for treason.
Right.
Are we seeing moral relativism here in the Marvel Universe?
That's a really good question. Are we seeing moral relativism in Marvel or in our own universe?
Well, probably both.
I mean, one of the themes of our chapter is we propose a contemporary view on what we would call morality. We might be accused of moral relativism, and we've actually put that in a paper we published in 2017, that some may be dissatisfied with our approach to morality, assuming it to be moral relativism. But I believe I'm speaking for Eric. You can tell me if I am not. But
jump in, Iron Man, if you like.
Exactly. I think we look at the phenomenon we call morality as a multi-scale phenomenon, people struggling to negotiate social relationships in real time, all the time. And so we like to consider every moment of human interaction a sort of management moment of multiple scales of the individual value, of dyad values, group values, culture values, and all of that is having its impact every moment. And we think that's an important way to start to look at morality.
It's very demanding.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
How do we make it through a single day with all that?
You make sure you don't get around the people that bother you.
Now, I think rather than moral relativism, perhaps a better phrase to sort of get at what you're talking about is moral complexity, right? And so, yeah. Yes, we're constantly navigating these different roles and these different expectations that others have for us than we have for ourselves. And one of the thrusts of most psychological views of morality is that when we adopt a moral framework, no matter what that framework is, once we finally learn and adopt it, we begin to sort of treat it as if it's intuitive, as if
a given.
A given. Yeah, so no moral discussions need to be held because this is right and this is wrong. And that's something that everybody does, once again, regardless of their worldview. But life is not that simple. And what happens when we inevitably run into a conflict where we have to do something or say something that, you know, conflicts with our values, or we endorse two values that conflict with one another,
yes,
right? And so, you know, we might call that cognitive dissonance, or the moral psychologists call that specific application moral dissonance, and it's unpleasant. And when it involves morality, it's really unpleasant.
You coin a term in your chapter, wild systems theory.
Mm-hmm.
Can you expand on that, Scott?
It's a different way of conceptualizing what I would call psychological functionality, how we do what we do. Traditional nomenclature is that we perceive, we think, and we act, and those are the sort of conceptual tools we bring to describing how we do what we do. And wild systems is an attempt to look at us more as living systems instead of computers, and looking at how living systems have to continuously engage their context at multiple levels in order to sustain themselves. And so when we look at a wild system, then would be a system that is sustaining itself in multiple scales continuously very well. So it doesn't mean out of control at all. It means massively embedded, massively engaged with context. And so calling something wild morality is a way of talking about the very hard work of being a good person every day. And one could say it's simply have your ideas fixed and then stick to it. One could also say it's navigating multiple scales of social constraint every day, every moment.
What can the characters from the Marvel Universe teach us about how to interact with each other with so many clashes of different moral views today? What can we learn from Iron Man and Thor and Captain America?
I would say that we learn from, in the Civil War arc, we learn from a lot of their mistakes. Very early on, they kind of pay lip service to try to see each other's side, but it very quickly devolves into name-calling and literal fistfights. There are moments where the characters try to reach across the aisles and do somewhat succeed, but then something happens to, you know, throw it all into a fight again. There was one single issue that Marvel did called What If, and it's sort of like a hypotheticals universe, and they showed different ways that Civil War, the story, could have ended. So it's a choose your own adventure, so to speak. And nope, I didn't take my finger off that page. I don't like that ending. There actually was a happy ending, and that really did involve Captain America and Iron Man swallowing their pride, actually listening to each other, and finding a way to find a truce. It wasn't easy, but it managed. But yeah, it obviously their main arc didn't end that way. So
I think that the characters in Civil War could actually serve to remind the American public about what our democracy is, which is a struggle among values. a persistent, never-ending struggle among values instead of among right and wrong. And I sense a certain collapse into binaries in our culture politically in the past 30 years. And the revitalization of a respectable struggle among values wouldn't be a bad thing. It's kind of ironic that the moral struggles I see in this comic book are much more sophisticated than the rhetoric I hear in nightly news. Those who are bashing comic books may want to do a rhetorical comparison of the themes being addressed by these characters and the complexity of their struggles versus the complexity of the rhetoric being used in our own political discussions.
Tell me about the reception so far of the book, Captain America versus Iron Man, Freedom, Security, and Psychology. So how does the Comic-Con set appreciate what you guys have been doing?
Well, we got to sign autographs. That was awesome.
Are you kind of becoming sort of celebrities?
Not yet. It was weird. We did two panels. Or Eric did three panels. We did a Star Trek, Star Wars panel, and then we did a Civil War panel the next day. I don't remember how many people there were at the Star Trek, Star Wars panel, but there were four or five times the number of people at the Civil War panel. It was a standing room only.
Why? Why do you think that?
Well, the contemporary movie. But the questions these people had were about morality. And was this person right doing this? Weren't they wrong? And then there were a lot of pseudopsychologists in the audience, you know, diagnosing various characters and stuff. But it was this amazing forum of people wanting to discuss what is morality and using these characters as tools. And it was an absolute blast. And it was thrilling.
That's Scott Jordan and Eric Wesselman, Illinois State University professors of psychology and authors of Wild Heroes, The Hard Work of Being Moral, in the new collection of essays entitled Captain America versus Iron Man, Freedom, Security, Psychology, from Sterling Books. I'm Laura Kennedy.
Jordan and Wesselman will again team up to contribute to upcoming books on Wonder Woman and Star Trek. The composer is Alan Silvestri, and the song is Captain America. At our website, WGLT.org, you can find individual stories and interviews heard during Sound Ideas, or look for the full entire episode podcast with help today from Charlie Schlenker, Mike McCurdy, and Laura Kennedy. Thanks to Kyle Hamm of the EDC for stopping by to talk about the Metrozone issue. I'm Willis Kern. Share your thoughts about Sound Ideas at facebook.com/WGLTFM. Email us at news@WGLT.org or tweet, use the hashtag Sound Ideas. I'm at WeKern. We're all at WGLT. News. I'm Willis Kern, and this is Sound Ideas. Thank you for choosing Sound Ideas on 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org. WGLT Normal.